As rents in the Bay Area and the Peninsula continue to skyrocket, the media are spending more time focusing on foreign investments. The San Francisco Business Times reports that for the very first time, one of the world's largest real estate developers, the Shanghai-based Greenland Holding Group, is in talks to invest and build in the Bay Area. Last year, foreign investors spent more than $92 billion on existing homes in the United States. On today's Your Call, we are talking about how global capital is affecting real estate and housing in Northern California. What questions do you have about global capital? And do you think there should be limits on foreign investors buying property? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Foreign capital is raining down on the Bay Area and the Peninsula. According to the San Francisco Business Times, the Beijing-based Oceanwide Holdings paid nearly $300 million for a mega development at First and Mission Streets in San Francisco. Chinese investors are also pouring money into mixed-use plots in Oakland and office towers in San Jose. The Business Times also reports that one of the world's largest real estate developers, the Shanghai-based Greenland Holding Group, is in talks to invest and build in the Bay Area for the very first time. Chinese investors have spent more than $600 million on Bay Area real estate over the last 2 years. That's according to Real Capital Analytics. Between April 2013 and March 2014, foreign investors purchased more than $92 billion worth of existing U.S. homes. About 60% of foreign buyers are paying cash, compared with one-third of domestic buyers. And this is getting a lot of attention now that rents continue to skyrocket, and in some cases, people are bidding more than $1 million over the asking price. So on today's Your Call, we are exploring the global real estate market. How is global capital affecting the Bay Area's social and economic landscape, and how is it affecting the housing crunch that we are currently facing? Today, we are joined by Bob Edelstein. He co-directs the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Development at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Bob is the author of the forthcoming book, Explaining the Boom Cycle, Speculation or Fundamentals, The Role of Real Estate in the Asian Crisis. He has served as a consultant to a number of agencies, including the U.S. Department of Housing and the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco. And Bob Edelstein joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Mava Elise Brown. She's co-founder and executive director of Housing and Economic Rights Advocates. That's a California nonprofit legal service and advocacy organization focused on housing rights. Mava Elise has been a public interest lawyer for 26 years, and she teaches a course she created on home ownership and mortgage lending at UC Berkeley's School of Law. She is on the Consumer Advisory Board of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And Mava joins us from her office in Berkeley. Hi, Mava Elise. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Bob, let's start off with you. First off, this is starting to get a lot more attention in the Bay Area. It's gotten attention for many, many years in New York. A lot of investigations have looked at foreign capital in New York. But how easy or difficult is foreign capital to track when it comes to how much people are spending on housing?
Well, it's probably not easy to track. The numbers you have indicated, probably you'll be told they're understated by some substantial amount. But with all that, foreign investment from all sources represent about 8% of the housing market, the real estate market in general. So it's not that the only thing in the marketplace. It does dominate in certain places and submarkets where there are particular interests. As you had indicated, foreign money likes to go to New York, likes to go to parts of California. Seattle's another place that's a target. In California, Los Angeles and San Francisco, Bay Area are the big targets. But it also goes to Nevada and other states, though not as readily. It doesn't go typically to the middle of the country.
And so it accounts for about 8% of the housing and real estate market. Do we know how that has changed over the last couple of years, especially in Northern California?
Well, in Northern California, because it's a target for Asian money, it has gone up. But really what we're seeing is growth in wealth around the world and people putting their money, in a sense, diversifying across different places. Now, there are really three types of players to sort of not get them confused. First, there are these large institutional investors, some and large corporations you referred to in your opening comments. They are very sophisticated. They are businessmen. They are making decisions like Western businessmen and U.S. companies. They're really no different, except they have lots of money that they've accumulated and think there are better opportunities here than elsewhere, partially as diversification, partially just listen to the news about what's happening in China right now, and you can see why they might want to have some money elsewhere. The second group are what I'll call middle-sized institutions or companies and high-net-worth individuals. They come from the China and Middle East is the bulk, and they also tend to be decision-makers, rational people. Then there are what I would call the cowboys and flight capital, and sometimes these get mixed in with the second group I discussed. They are looking to put money somewhere else, sometimes as a safe haven, sometimes in China now for political reasons, you want to have a place to go to. And then there's a group in there which I call the EB-5s, which is not only people getting these green cards or visas to the United States, but people who want to make sure they have money elsewhere for safety's sake. And typically, they are not looking at investment as a rate of return. They're looking as a place to have capital when you need it. They're paying all, some of them are very, very high-end buyers, can spend $10 million on a house. And I've spoken to one, so I said, you know, that's pretty expensive for what's been happening in the marketplace. And he confessed, he said, if it fell by 30%, I'd have $7 million, and if I need the money, it's here.
Hmm.
I'm sure. And they like the safety and security of the United States. By the way, we're not the only people being exposed to this. If we talk about China as a place of investing, if you just continue, this sort of gives us a global picture. First, they went to Hong Kong. And Hong Kong had the same problem, a very small place, you know, 8 million people with 1.4 billion trying of the very richest people from the 1.4 billion investing in Hong Kong. They put in a 15% stamp tax. So for non-residents, read that as PRC resident. So if you are from China and you invest in Hong Kong, if you're from mainland China, you pay 15% stamp tax up front. They then discovered Singapore. Singapore put in a similar type of tax. They are in London, less in Paris, New York, and the West Coast. This wealth is finding places to invest, and sometimes it's for safety, sometimes it's just to have a place to be, and all these other reasons.
And Maeva Elise, how new is this in Northern California? And I'm sure it's been going on for a while, but in terms of what we're seeing in the Bay Area, so for example, I'm hearing of all of these new developments in condos by the Embarcadero, and they are being bought almost as soon as they are put on the market. And most of the people are from overseas and they're paying cash. How new is that?
The frequency with which properties are being snapped up by all cash buyers in this range of the market in the Bay Area seems to be unprecedented, and so the folks, our office serves people from low through moderate income, and it's putting the squeeze on people who are, it's putting the squeeze ultimately eventually on everybody, because it means that there's less supply available for folks who cannot afford an all-cash investment, and it's having the effect of helping to reduce the amount of available housing for folks. That drives prices up, and it's driving prices up in the homeownership side of the market as well as the rental side.
And so for those of us who really want to understand how this works, help us really follow the money, because in some cases, it's difficult to know who owns what. The New York Times had an investigation recently that looked at the Time Warner Center on Columbus Circle in New York City and found that the majority of owners have taken steps to keep their identities hidden, registering condos and trusts, limited liability companies, or other entities that shield their names. So we talked a bit about how difficult it is to really follow the money, but what have you found in your research?
That it's also difficult to follow ownership for the very reasons that you discussed. Now, some of the people who are purchasing in all cash investments are not making huge efforts to shield. But if you're trying to, the more you get into more structured investment in property, then you're talking about having essentially a variety of people with their money tied up. So it's a different beast, as Bob was saying, when you have more institutional investors, where the names of the primary holders in the company, leaders of the company, are public, but you don't really know who all the investors are who are participating in the deal.
There are even some things that are sort of making people from overseas try to hide their. It's because of a new law called FIRPTA, which not a new law, a relatively new law, that basically is the a real property investment guide, and has a guide for withholding. And if you invest as equity, you will have to have withholding taxes. People don't like to do that. So they put in frequently as debt, which that is not easy to follow, and it's convertible debt. So they do own if they want to, but they don't show up as owners. So there's lots of things going on that are sort of tax-related as well.
Right, and in some cases, these new condos are empty, so the people who have bought them for investments don't live in them. Can you explain why that happens, Bob? What do they gain from that?
Well, first of all, this phenomena happened in the north, in Vancouver, long ago, when Hong Kong was being repatriated to China. The Commonwealth effect occurred, and people from Hong Kong who were wealthy were buying condos just as they are now in California, in Vancouver, not occupying them, just having them. And so they basically, it's a store of value. And in fact, in China itself, given the options for investment, and that's one of the things driving this, by the way, is that you wouldn't, given what you see in the stock market in Shenzhen and Hong Kong and Shanghai recently, you would like to be not in the stock market. So people buy real estate. Mm. But now real estate doesn't look nearly as attractive in sort of parts of China, most of China. And so they are looking elsewhere. In China, there are, at the very high end, lots and lots of unused, unlived in, basically stores of value as perceived by the investors. They're doing the same thing here.
Bob Edelstein co-directs the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Development at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. He's author of the forthcoming book, Explaining the Boom Cycle, Speculation or Fundamentals, The Role of Real Estate in the Asian Crisis. We're also joined by Mava Elise Brown. She's co-founder and executive director of Housing and Economic Rights Advocates. That's a statewide nonprofit legal service and advocacy organization focused on housing rights in California. She's also on the Consumer Advisory Board of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And today, we are talking about how global investment is affecting real estate and housing in Northern California. As we are seeing rents skyrocket, we're seeing people spend $1 million more than asking price for real estate. What questions do you have about how global capital is affecting this? If you are in real estate, we want to hear from you. Are you seeing more foreign investment in the Bay Area? I recently met a real estate agent in Fairfax, and she said just in the last 6 months, homes are going for more than about for $50,000 to $100,000 than they were going 6 months ago. She said she cannot put a piece of property on the market for less than about $600,000, and that was not the case last year. So if you're in real estate, what are you seeing? Are you seeing more foreign investments in the Bay Area? And if you're a renter or a prospective home buyer, how is global capital affecting your ability to find a home or an affordable apartment? Do you think there should be limits on this? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And because this is, it is hard to follow the money, there have been a lot more media reports. If you have any basic questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I have been talking about this subject for many, many years. And, you know, if you go, for instance, to Berkeley, the whole city of Berkeley look like big, giant construction zone, huge, everywhere. Every street have a huge building with the destroying landmarks, building this box building, all, by the way, the same color. And that is also a message, the all yellow. But the at the same time, where you have all this construction everywhere, there's apartment for rent everywhere. Mm. Apartment for rent everywhere. But the thing is, apartment that's only going for maybe 600 or 900, only a few years ago, now it's 2,400, 3,000, 3,500, 4,000.
Right.
Not, and that also, what we ignore, the terrible, cozy relationship between the mayors, specifically Berkeley, Mayor Bates, and San Francisco, Mayor Lee, was those guys. Totally, totally corrupt relationship. And even that may have shed some light to that balcony collapse, because these construction companies, they're building them as cheap as possible. First, they buy property from usually private people who own these lots, and then they buy it very cheap, and then they spend as little money as possible. Then they create tens of apartments at 4,000 apartment average right now. You get a horrible situation, and we really have to start paying attention and make a recall against corrupt Mayor Bates, who really destroyed the city of Berkeley, and corrupt Mayor Lee, who really destroyed the city of San Francisco. None of that stuff would happen with either guys in office.
Well, thank you, Ede. Someone just posted on my Facebook page a three-bedroom in San Francisco, 1,800 square feet, going for $7,500 per month for a three-bedroom. Mava Elise, what are your thoughts on the role that local governments, mayors, for example, mayors of Berkeley and San Francisco, are playing in this?
I think that it's the tendency of municipalities in most places to go ahead and cozy up to money in any way that they can. And that means horrible choices get made. They make horrible choices when it comes to development. There's more of an interest in just, this is a fundamental problem in the way in which cities, municipalities fund themselves. To the extent that they're funded by developer fees, that the existence of the city, that its cash flow is affected by fees, then you have horrible decision making that really just doesn't take into account what the lives of the average person. And I don't think there's a complete lack of interest in the lives of the average citizenry, but I think at the end of the day, money frequently just wins out.
And Bob, what are your thoughts about the role local governments are playing?
Well, I think the way this has been posed, it doesn't really take in the complexity. The driving force for raising rents and values is not foreign money, first of all. It is that we are in a very, very successful economic region. This problem isn't happening in Kansas City. But it is happening here. And the problem is, on one side, we've had sort of this enormous growth in the high-tech area, which has very high-income employees, and lots of them, and young, and they want to live in San Francisco, for instance, and they bid up rents. The supply does not adjust. We need to have a major rethinking of how we really have higher density in cities, so we can create supply. You can't create more land, really, so you need to use the land more effectively. And so, in some long-run sense, if we're going to be a high-income place and we don't adjust the supply, then we're going to have rents increase over time, and we're going to have values increase. And if you add on foreign money from outside, that just exacerbates the situation. So it's in part, it's government has to respond, but it's state, local, and even federal responses. And it means low-income people are going to be priced out unless you do some adjustment for them.
Well, and I also wanted to ask you both how global capital drives housing development, because the Atlantic City Lab website reported that extremely wealthy foreign investors were driving the construction of super luxury high-rises in New York City. And if you read the New York Times, you see ads for these massive, you know, $15 million condos in New York City on a regular basis. In some cases, $100 million duplex penthouses with five bedrooms. And so they report that because foreign investment is flourishing, you're just seeing the development of very super luxury high-rises. So how does that affect what kind of development that we're seeing in the Bay Area? Bob, do you want to take that first?
Well, there's a similar type of issue, though New York is New York and London are unique.
Right.
Paris is probably just behind that, but mostly Europeans. And by the way, it's not just Chinese. There are Canadians, United Kingdom, India, and China are the largest investors. And actually, in some parts of the country, Mexican investors. So it's not just Chinese, which is sort of overplayed, though they are obviously the latest guys to the game. And they have shifted from buying treasuries to buying equity in housing and buildings and then the stock market. So as we look at this, we think places that are targets for high-income people and high-wealth people, those prices are going to go up and you're going to see development like that. But there's a good side to that. These people pay property taxes. Maybe it's time to adjust the property tax system so they pay for this and they will subsidize other things. And with that, if you had good better public transit, you can sort of have the high-income people living in downtowns where they want to live and other people living elsewhere and increasing density simultaneously.
Well, and I mean, but the problem in the Bay Area is that how many people can we fit here, right? I mean, we're going to do a show about infrastructure, and with all of these new condos being built, how many more people can we fit in a tiny city like San Francisco?
Well, infrastructure is part of the problem everywhere. You know, the United States has not really taken care of infrastructure. You know, think about how many new freeways you've seen, you know, things like that. So, yes, we have to think about infrastructure, but we could still increase density. There are low density areas in San Francisco that could be increased and along the Bay Area.
We're going to do a show about it.
Not a pleasant thought. People don't like that.
People don't because the traffic is horrendous and public transportation, I mean, we can have a whole show about that and I'm sure we will, but it needs major, major upgrades. I mean, if the city's going to bring in this many people, they've got to change the infrastructure and greatly improve the infrastructure.
Obviously. I mean, these things go hand in hand.
And
no question about it.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to do a show about that. But back to that question, Mava Elise, about how global capital affects the kind of housing development we see. What really strikes you about what you're seeing in the Bay Area and the peninsula?
I think that Bob's point is really well taken, that this is not just a matter of that there are some other complexities here besides foreign capital. But I will note that one of the complexities is the purchase has been the rollout from the foreclosure crisis, from the Great Recession. We've gone through a tremendous cycle of what I see as manipulation of our single-family housing market. With mass foreclosures, we have a lot of properties that were being withheld from the market after foreclosure, because I believe the investors, banks, other domestic investors, did not want to flood the market, did not want to turn the properties around for what they were really worth at that point. And so we've had many years of shadow inventory. We had a squelching of what should have been the natural life cycle of the property at that point, which is it should have been reoffered to the public closer to the point in time when it was foreclosed on. That means that renters could have then in turn afforded to buy the home, move out of the rental market, free up some of those units for the next round of people, who needed a place to live, and we could have had some of the horrible pressure in our Bay Area market. That could have been the release valve. Instead, since we have no controls over just simply keeping property off of the market and a ton of property off of the market in this fashion, what we had is an artificial driving up of our Bay Area market.
And Mava Elise, hold that thought. Today we are talking about how global investment is affecting real estate. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Again, it's a toll-free call. If you'd rather write than get on the phone, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you just want to leave a comment, you can do that as well at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, from our friends at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, it's Bina. And then this afternoon at 1, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. It's Open Air with David Latulli.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will talk about the economic crisis in Greece. What strikes you about how that is being covered? Last Sunday, Greek voters flatly rejected austerity measures. How are the media covering the human cost of austerity? And then next week, we will kick off another water series focusing on solutions. We'll be talking about the most water-efficient cities in the world. What can we learn from cities around the world? We'll be talking about pricing. We'll be talking about recycling water. And then, does living in a drier world mean eating less meat? That is next week, and we hope you can tune in. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how global investment is affecting real estate and housing in the Bay Area. As our guest said, we are seeing an unprecedented amount of money being poured into the Bay Area and the peninsula when it comes to buying up real estate. And we've got investors. China definitely gets the most attention. But as Bob Edelstein says, there are investors from India, Mexico, Canada, China. Bob, anybody else? Anyone else on that list? Other countries?
Well, I think those are the – if you looked at the – there's a recent survey by the National Association of Realtors. Those are the five largest – China, Canada, our neighbors, obviously, India, Mexico, and the U.K. There are also some Europeans, though Europeans, continental Europeans, tend to go to London or Paris. And they're having the same problems in those cities, by the way, that we're talking about.
Right. And that is Bob Edelstein. He co-directs the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Development at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and he's author of the forthcoming book, Explaining the Boom Cycle, Speculation or Fundamentals, the Role of Real Estate in the Asian Crisis. We're also joined by Mava Elise Brown. She's co-founder and executive director of Housing and Economic Rights Advocates. That's a nonprofit legal service and advocacy organization focused on housing rights in California. Mava Elise is on the Consumer Advisory Board of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about global investment, if you work in real estate, we would love to hear from you. What changes have you seen? What really strikes you about what you're seeing? And if you're a renter, if you're on the market to rent or buy, how's your experience been? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Ron in Salinas. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
It's actually Juan, not a very common Mexican name, but that's okay. How you doing?
Hi, Juan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, you know, thank you. Appreciate it. You know, I wanted just to chime in. I turned it on right when you guys were talking about this renter issue. My comment was, yes, foreign investment is definitely making headway into the ability of people to buy their own home. My comment is this. We have become undoubtedly a renter society. Look at any subdivision, and sometimes you'll have more than half of a suburban subdivision being populated by renters. And there's nothing wrong with that. Apparently there's nothing wrong with that. But when you start digging deeper, that's bad for society. America, if you talk about the American dream, it's built on a couple things, on the car, if you will, and, you know, the house, you know, if you want me to generalize it. But if it was me, one of the speakers said that, you know, he needs federal government to get involved and maybe the state government to get involved, which hasn't happened. You know, I'm going to say something real wild here. Does that mean that at some point somebody's going to have to say, you know what, here's a subdivision of 1,000 homes. No more than 20% of these homes may be rented. And would that cause something? I don't want to sound overly socialist, but something's got to be done here because, shoot, if it was me, if I was Home Depot and Lowe's, I'd be lobbying in Washington heavy because as soon as people own a home, they go out and spend money to fix it. A renter never does that. And an owner who rents the home out is not going to want to invest into the house. That's typical. It's textbook in real estate that they just do not reinvest. And therefore, most people cannot buy the home, as you guys have been mentioning. Mm. So my comment is, why not allow the federal government to get involved and say, you know what, here's 1,000 homes, no more than this percentage may be rented out. The rest of them have to be single-family dwelling. And, you know, the Small Business Administration regulates that when you get a loan from them, you have to occupy 50%. Why can't we do that in the real estate market? Say, you know what, you know, you're in these homes, I want to make sure that, you know, these speculators are not doing just that, speculating. And these homes need to be owned by the people living in them. I mean, I don't know, it's kind of a wild comment, but it makes sense to me.
Well, thank you so much. And that's an ongoing debate, right? Renting versus buying. Bob, do you want to take that one?
Well, that's a complex, compound question if I were on the stand and testifying. But so let me sort of break it down into parts. There are several things going on that are working against ownership right now. Mm-hmm. One is that there has been a significant tightening in underwriting standards from what they were during the loosey-goosey days of 2005, 2006, which got us into problems. So part of this phenomena you observe in tracts where there are lots of renters versus owners is a residual of the bad times that occurred when the market collapsed. And now it's hard for people to qualify. And the lenders, for a number of reasons, have become very, very careful in their underwriting standards, something they probably should have been somewhere between they were what they were and where they are now. But that requires regulation. They are a lender. If you ever speak to a lender and an underwriter, they are crossing every T and dotting every I because they don't want the loan to come back to them if it defaults. And the reps and warranties, as the expression is, they represent that this is a good loan made under certain standards. And that is really hurting people at the lower end of the home buying structure. And we need to do something about that. But that requires – and there are ways to handle it. And the Obama administration is trying to do something about it, but it's a very difficult thing because simultaneously we need to get the private sector financial institutions involved in a way that they are more reluctant than they were before. Mm. And so it's complex on the financing. If we could increase the financing ability, we would get more ownership. I don't think we want to go back to where we were and have loans that are, if you can leave a fog on the application with your, when you can get the loan.
There's your point is great, but there are also some other large factors. And I know the focus of the show is on foreign money, so I will note that Blackstone Group is a multinational private equity investment banking group based in New York, and it's one of the largest entities. They were the first ones to securitize single-family homes into rental properties and investments. And I really think it speaks to the caller's point in a variety of ways, because a group like Blackstone and the other groups that are sometimes agglomerations of money globally are buying up properties hundreds and thousands at a time for rental. And that locks out people who would normally buy. It also means that you have a player in a concentration of when you have a concentration of ownership like that in any particular area or community, they can set prices where they want to. If you get evicted from a home, if that's your landlord, you're never going to rent from them again. And when they control a lot of the rental market, that's a huge problem. The issue of property maintenance, which our caller raised, is also huge, because when you when you're treating your properties with that sort of a short-term turnover investment perspective, and that's what the single-family rental securitization deals look like. That seems to be how they're structured. There's no interest in investing in maintenance of the property. And it's a problem that residents are tracking in many different cities, and advocacy groups are tracking. The effect, the negative effect of this money, it's global money that's looking to make as much as it can. If this is the particular opportunity that presents itself now, this is what they're going to go for. We have the largest one of these deals just closed in June. Not a Blackstone deal. It was Invitation Homes, I believe, closed in June of this year. There was another one that closed in April. And what also struck me about the caller's comment was this term renter society. That is what the investors are talking about with great excitement. America turning, literally quoted in articles, saying America's turning into a renter society. Well, homeownership is the primary way in which most Americans build wealth in this country. And if we are, or if we're going to say this is a country of renters, what are we saying about the ability of people to actually build wealth for the future, do better than they're doing now? I mean, the implications are devastating.
And Mava Elise, you mentioned Invitation Homes. The East Bay Express had a piece called Tenants Renting from Wall Street Pay More. It also mentions Colony American Homes and Waypoint Homes. These are three of the largest so-called Wall Street landlords. And a tenants' rights group conducted a survey and found that 20% of tenants who live in these Wall Street-owned homes say that their landlord is making only minimal repairs. They're unresponsive to requests for service. 13% of tenants said their housing conditions include mold, rats, lack of insulation. And then while this is really also interesting, while African Americans account for 6.6% of California's population, they make up 26% of the survey respondents living in these Wall Street landlord homes.
Yeah, the fair housing implications are tremendous. That's an incredibly disturbing statistic, because then you're talking about one particular group being particularly affected by subject to lousy housing conditions.
I think that this, Bob, is another side to this that really has to come out. It turns out that many of these deals that were, and by the way, I don't like to be on the side of defending Blackstone. They can defend themselves. They don't need me for sure. Many of these deals were structured that they were going to sell after a while. So they were buying inventory cheaply because no one else could. And they were then going to rent for a while. And frequently, they were targeting the renter as the ultimate owner or buyer. Waypoint, which is a San Francisco company, is very good people that had that issue in mind and that approach. It has been harder to sell, partially because there's no financing out there. So people end up being renters. And by the way, ownership has gone from 69-70% under the Bush administration to about 63% now. So it's not like we're a renter society. There are places where we are heavily renters in very expensive markets. New York City, a lot of people rent because it's a very expensive market, has been historically. And so this problem is probably real, but somewhat overstated in the sense that the exit strategy did not work for the Blackstones as they had planned. So now they're trying to find a new strategy, which is to be a longer-term renter strategy, landlord strategy, and eventually sell. Because otherwise, this is not an efficient way to run rental properties. Having 500 properties across the landscape versus one building is just not efficient.
There's actually a huge amount of interest still in the hedge fund market and in the high wealth, the high large scale heavy hitter investor market in this model. And they may be shifting in terms of deciding when they want to turn properties over, although the way they've structured their investments is going to for and pay out to the investors in the securities is going to raise some big questions about whether or not rental properties are going to end up dumped back onto market en masse, or what's going to happen when, and back to some of your earlier questions, when municipalities, one thing municipalities can do is certainly enforce housing standards. That part, those laws
sure.
are in place. That's going to be a very real cost to the owners of the property if enforcement activity is strong. But there was a very real locking out of the average resident from purchasing homes by the preference of banks and the holders of real estate-owned, so post-foreclosure real estate-owned properties, their preference for cash buyers, and their preference to sell in bulk. And that problem was exacerbated as well by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac deciding to release distressed properties in bulk into the private market. So it locked people out, and that meant it was – so there are many – in this mini multi-layered – I don't want to call it a cake because it's not a delicious recipe here, but in this multi-layered problem, there are ways in which our federal and local governments could take some steps to help your average American.
Well, so how can the federal and local government take steps to do that? We have an email from Nita who says, I hate to lay this at San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee's feet, as this manufactured crisis has been a decade in the making, but it's his responsibility, along with our local and state officials, to act immediately to stop the evaporation of housing for those made vulnerable by the unleashed market. Nita writes, I'm a long-term resident. I have some protections with rent control and an honorable landlord who's just a regular guy, for whom I am grateful. So, Mava, Elise, what steps would you like to see the government take?
Well, there needs to be a real analysis of how much affordable housing. And, you know, there's a duty of localities nationally to go ahead and affirmatively further fair housing. HUD just released its updated proposed rule on affirmatively furthering fair housing, but that duty has existed. And what we're looking at here really is in addition to everything else, a backlog of unmet affordable housing need, but I think a lack of willingness on the part of municipalities to sufficiently prioritize up the building of affordable housing over luxury housing. So, you know, Bob made a great point about density questions, but in turn, we have no single piece of the puzzle can be pulled out from the stack here without dealing with infrastructure and traffic and answering some big questions about who should bear the financial responsibility when you come in financial responsibility to house people who are living in your area. Who has the responsibility to deal with displacement? In my opinion, local government absolutely has a responsibility to protect its residents and to make sure that people are not just subject to the whims of having a large, well-heeled employer come in. And that means asking for more concessions, maybe from employers, than they have before. Bob mentioned as a possible idea, maybe the tax structure, property tax structure, for some of the institutional property owners should reflect their greater ability to pay and their greater effect upon the market.
And that is Mava Elise Brown. She's co-founder and executive director of Housing and Economic Rights Advocates, a statewide nonprofit legal service and advocacy group working on housing rights. She's on the Consumer Advisory Board of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Bob Edelstein co-directs the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Development at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Explaining the Boom Cycle, Speculation or Fundamentals, the Role of Real Estate in the Asian Crisis. We've got a number of callers on the line. So let's try to get through as many as we can before we have to end. Let's hear next from Nan in Monterey. Hi, Nan. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Good morning. I just wanted to tell you about my recent experience buying a home in Monterey County. you will not be able to get your hands on a home until it has filtered through one of these very large businesses who buy up groups of homes, and they live out of state, so they don't have to fulfill the requirements of a regular home seller. That this was a law that the I don't know if the state or federal passed it, but they don't have to fulfill regular inspections because they just sign off on everything and say they never lived here.
Huh.
So you do finally you get the house and you buy it, and you can see what they do is they sort of just spit shine the house. You buy it and you literally have to do everything to make this house work. No insulation. You're just going to have deferred maintenance because of the people who originally bought these homes during the crash never had any money to fix them either. So what I see happening is a huge, huge loss of housing stock here in California with homes that are literally being ruined because lack of maintenance. And it's very hard to even get your hands on one of these homes. You're fighting. And if you get a house, you know, it's usually going to be a home, even anything $800,000 and under, that needs a lot of work. And it's already filtered through the hands of these multinational companies, as did ours, and almost every single house we look at over in the Monterey area.
Wow. Well, thank you, Nan. I've been hearing similar stories more north of Monterey. Bob, do you want to comment on that?
Well, there are sort of economic incentives here. People are trying to, as the market gets better, dispose of these houses. And it's true that sometimes the networking on how housing becomes available is not perfect. But and by the way, as I just purchased with my son for him. For his a house in Los Angeles where he lives, and we went through some of the similar things. But it was a hot neighborhood, and there were five bidders on every house that we bid on.
Wow.
And it took us a sixth house to get there. So, if the market heats up, this will correct itself. We also will have to put in a very 20% of what we paid will have to be put in for renovation because these houses have not been well maintained during the downturn and whoever owned them. And so this is a common problem no matter who owns them. And if they're out of state or less involved investors, they're just looking for the turnaround. They just maybe put some paint on the house. It is a problem. But on the other hand, you are now in the house. You're going to take care of it. That's what we really need to do. And I wouldn't ask, but if you financed it, you may have found it a little trickier and more paperwork than you ever had imagined.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your story, Nan. Let's go next to Marco in San Francisco. Hi, Marco. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I got a couple points. First of all, the idea of affordable. I live in San Francisco. I bought a BMR below market rate house back in 2008, and the value has gone down significantly. And as probably your guests know, you know, developers need to dedicate a certain amount of their construction to BMR available housing. And what's starting to happen down here, where I live down in Bayview, what's starting to happen is a lot of the folks that were originally bought into the program are starting to go outside of the program and rent their BMR units to people that don't qualify. And in one case, we have a house was defaulted on, and somehow the bank was able to sell it outside of the program to just an investor in LA who's using it as a BM, like an Airbnb type of rental unit. So my point is, I think there is a lot of accountability that needs to happen on the part of the city, in this case, the city of San Francisco. As much as the mayor says he's committed to affordable housing, yet we have BMR units that are being rented out to whoever can pay $3,000-$4,000 a month for a two-bedroom unit.
Well, thank you for calling. I'll get a response in just a minute. I want to take a few more callers. Let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I have a question that might be naive. Let me turn my radio off.
Thank you.
Might be naive, or I don't know, it might be revolutionary, but I've been wondering for a long time, is it possible, it's about regulation, is it possible for like either a legislative body like the Board of Supervisors or even the state, or through a ballot initiative, to make a schedule of, like, to cap prices for rents and purchases and sales, like to make a schedule of allowable rents so that and house prices so that it's affordable, so that it's reasonable.
All right.
In other words, can they regulate the prices? And then that would get rid of a lot of this crazy speculation.
Thank you for that. We're going to take one more call, and then we'll get answers. Let's hear from Ben in San Francisco. Hi, Ben.
Hey, guys. Great conversation. Thanks for having me on. It's wonderful to hear informed voices kind of talking about the national and international context of what is undoubtedly a housing crisis in the Bay Area.
And, Ben, we're almost out of time, so if you can be brief, that would be great.
Super fast. But here's what it is. Housing prices are definitely going up, but I think we should be responsible about how we talk about this. I heard one of your guests earlier frame it as, the overbidding on properties is $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 over asking on different houses. I think that can be a little bit deceptive because, of course, that doesn't reflect the actual asset prices and price per square feet or anything like that, more so just a tactic that a real estate agent might be using to drum up interest in the property. So I'll take my
All right. Thank you. I mean, there have been cases of people bidding over $1 million, but obviously every case is different. Just quickly, Judy asked, putting caps on how property is sold. Bob, do you ever see anything like that playing out?
Well, rent control is, in a sense, like that. It affects the value of the property by having the rent stream controlled. And so that's similar notion. Those things don't work in the long run because it stifles supply in the long run. So it may help you in a pinch for a while, but if you leave them too long, and once you put them in, it sort of tends to be forever. New York City is a place where rent control has never quite left, though it's changed remarkably. So very, very dangerous for if you want to enhance supply in the long run.
And final thoughts, Bob, 30 seconds. Where do you see this going? I mean, we're getting so many emails. Obviously, there's so much interest in this issue.
Yeah. Well, the problem is very simple, that there's too much demand for the supply.
Yep.
And you need to have some way in which we enhance supply and permit ease financing so people who can qualify reasonably do qualify. And simultaneously, there is a responsibility of the local governments to make sure that units are safe and hazard-free. And so some enforcement will help in some of the issues that were raised earlier. But the problem is one of success in the Bay Area, abstracting from foreign money. And that's a problem.
Bob Edelstein co-directs the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Development at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and Mava Elise Brown is co-founder and executive director of Housing and Economic Rights Advocates. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the economic crisis in Greece. Last Sunday, Greek voters flatly rejected austerity measures. All eyes are now focused on negotiations between Greece and its creditors. How are the media covering the human cost of austerity? We'll be joined by McClatchy's Kevin Hall, The Globe and Mail's Eric Reguli, and independent journalist Yiannis Baboulias. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.